What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together today of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Rabbi Jonathan Greenberg, Senior Vice President of the Chaim Soloman Center. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Too Jewish Maven on Israel, Oshrat Barel, and our Maven on Jewish Education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. What's the most important institution in Jewish life? Judaism's existed for 3,800 years, and over the centuries, we've had a variety of organizations that have effectively served God and the Jewish people. Each has played an important role in the continuing evolution of our religion and identity. But there's no doubt that the single most important institution in all of Jewish history is the synagogue. We began as desert nomads, wandering a wilderness far more barren than the Sonoran desert, tribes coalescing around charismatic patriarchs and matriarchs. We followed a great innovative leader, Moses, and formed into a people focused on a tabernacle and its priesthood. We came into our own promised land, followed judges, set up courts of justice, appointed war leaders in times of crisis, and eventually became a monarchy with kings joining priests in leadership. We built a great ritual temple for the priests and the kings. Prophets arose and steered us towards righteousness and belief. Eventually, scribes and scholars created the legal and ethical basis for a new portable Judaism. The literary legacy of Judaism in Bible and Talmud was preserved permanently, but an odd little general-purpose entity was created over the late stages of antiquity, starting about 2,300 years ago. The synagogue, a place of assembly, study, prayer, and communal life. The synagogue, or temple, or shul, or congregation, was the institution that had both the integrity and flexibility to provide essential services for the Jewish people, while changing and evolving with the times. The great temple was grander. With its highly celebrated priesthood, the king had more power and influence, the prophets spoke with God's own voice. The Sanhedrin was the judicial authority, yet all disappeared, while the humble synagogue remained the center of Judaism. In every era, new Jewish institutions arose. Some seemed destined to be greater than the synagogue. Communal leadership organizations, fundraising groups, Jewish community centers, Jewish political organizations, social groups, yeshivot, and other schools arose and grew. All served important roles in the Jewish world, yet each, after periods of centrality or even predominance, receded. Even those that became permanent parts of the Jewish world changed so dramatically they were unrecognizable. But in every era, and for each new generation, the essential role of the synagogue remained. Jews, in order to remain Jews, must have a place for prayer, spirituality, Jewish learning, life cycle celebrations, memorials, festival observances, social justice, and true community. Jews, in order to continue Judaism through each new generation, need a temple to cultivate and model values, meaning, holiness. Jews, in order to bring new entrants into our people, need a congregation that teaches, prays, celebrates, welcomes, and remembers. It is the synagogue. In every generation, it is always the synagogue for more than 23 centuries and counting that has proven to be our most important living link to God and to each other. For reasons that are understandable, but, well, wrong, contemporary Jews are always looking for replacements for the synagogue. I don't need to send my kid to the temple's religious school for bar mitzvah training. I can just find a rabbi online. I don't have to come to services. I can pray on my own or just not pray or have any spirituality. I can send money to support Israel and feel that I've done my part for Jewish continuity. I have Jewish values or cultural preferences, and that's enough. But inevitably, the only place where Judaism is really preserved, taught, grown, and revitalized is the synagogue, the temple. So, if you are Jewish, go visit a temple for Shabbat this week, or take a Taste of Judaism class, or come for Torah study, or call and make arrangements to come in and see what your local temple has to offer. You will be pleasantly surprised and gratified, and it will make a very positive difference in your life. To play us in this morning on Too Jewish, on that theme, here's Dan Nichols' song, Kehila Kedosha, a sacred congregation. Kedosha! Lai, 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 lai. Dan Nichols' Kehila Kedosha, a holy congregation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish, Rabbi Jonathan Greenberg, is a dynamic young advocate for Israel, the senior vice president of the advocacy organization based in Chicago, the Chaim Solomon Center, which works on behalf of Israel in some very creative ways. Find out how when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
It's everything you wanted to know about Judaism but were afraid to ask. Temple Emmanuel's Taste of Judaism program is now in its 17th year and explores Judaism in 3 2-hour sessions on Jewish spirituality, values, and community. This free introductory class taught by our rabbis is immensely popular throughout Southern Arizona. 6,000 students have enjoyed Taste to date, and you can too. In partnership with the Tucson Hebrew Academy, Taste of Judaism brings to life Jewish culture, history, rituals, and practice. It'll help you rediscover your roots or simply satisfy your curiosity about Judaism. Classes are free and open to all and include Jewish snacks. We have daytime and evening classes in Central, Northwest, and East Tucson, and this year at Splendido as well. The whole family can learn at the Taste of Judaism family class, starting soon. It's free with no fees or obligations, but space is limited and pre-registration is required. Call Mila at 327-4501 or email Mila, M-I-L-A, at tetucson.org. That's Taste of Tucson, 520-327-4501.
We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning. Rabbi Jonathan Greenberg is a senior vice president of the Chaim Solomon Center for American Jewish Thought in Chicago. He is a voice on foreign policy. It's been carried in a variety of newspapers and media outlets and works to present a positive image of Israel and counteract some of the other information out there in the media. Good morning and welcome to Too Jewish.
Good morning.
So explain, this is a question that has bothered me since I heard the name. Why is the Chaim Solomon Center located in Chicago instead of Philadelphia?
That's a great question. Well, because the founders happened to live in Chicago is the first reason. You know, there really isn't very much about Chaim Solomon anywhere, but oddly enough, on Wacker Drive, here in Chicago, there is a statue of Chaim Solomon and President Washington.
Wow.
Yeah.
So Chaim Solomon, of course, a Jewish hero of the American Revolution, not maybe as well known as he should be, but tell us what the Chaim Solomon Center does and the motivation for creating it.
Solomon Center is a news and public policy organization that creates hard news and opinion editorial content for placement in the mainstream press. And the idea is to change the cultural understanding of Israel and more broadly U.S. foreign policy, liberal democracy, and Western civilization in the mainstream press. So we're not focused on the Jewish press per se.
I'm getting it into the mainstream press rather than the Jewish press. You worked for AIPAC for, I don't know, 5 years or so. What led you to this direction instead of staying with AIPAC?
Well, I left AIPAC actually to run for office in 2011. I ran for office in 2012, so I was already out of AIPAC. I went into the think tank world, and then in 2014, the most recent war between Israel and Hamas in Gaza took place, and I realized, you know, I was doing more state-level policy, and I realized that the thing that I'm most passionate about, that I care the most about, is Israel and what's happening in Israel and how I could help kind of guide the debate in our country about Israel. My friend Paul Miller, who's the president and executive director of the Solomon Center, we've been friends for 25 years. Paul is a trained journalist and had already been working on this project for a different think tank, and he kind of took it more in the Israel and international affairs direction and away from the terrorism that the think tank he was working for wanted him to work on. So he spun it off into its own nonprofit, and I jumped aboard in January of 2015, and we've grown pretty dramatically since then.
We will talk much more about the Chaim Solomon Center and about how the media portrays Israel and what the major issues are now when we come back in a few minutes with Jonathan Greenberg here on Too Jewish. We welcome our friends from Freedom Smoke, David and Pamela. You guys focus so much on your customers. Tell us why they're so important to you.
Our customers are extremely important to us. It's why we built this company. Our job is to get people to quit smoking, and we're extremely good at it. You can come in a very nice, comfortable lounge environment, try anything you want to try. You'll have knowledgeable and helpful staff that will be happy to get you or your family and loved ones to quit smoking.
We have 4 locations in Tucson, 1 in Catalina on the Pinal border, and our latest store has just opened in Sierra Vista.
And these are all lounges, sort of a comfortable environment for people to come in.
Yes, they're set up with couches and pool tables, pinball machines, video games, anything to help you along with your time.
What's the best way for people to find out more information?
They can go onto our website at freedomsmokeusa.com or call our toll-free hotline for any information that you want, 1-800-705-7013.
And that number again is
1-800-705-7013.
Thanks so much. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, email us at toojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's toojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at toojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website. Streaming us there or downloading us from the Apple iTunes Store is very popular Jewish podcasts. We have 2.5 months until we elect a new president of these United States, and we continue our 2016 Too Jewish Presidential Report. Last week, 40 American Orthodox clergy co-signed a letter condemning Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump for what they called his hateful rhetoric and intolerant policy proposals. The letter, whose signatories included Rabbi Irving Yitz Greenberg, the founding president of Klal and last week's guest right here on Too Jewish, was published on the website cleveland.com. Noting that religion should be invoked with care when addressing politics, the rabbis added, nevertheless, there are times when the political political discourse veers into morally offensive language and policy proposals that violate fundamental religious norms. Our core religious values and essential theological beliefs require us to condemn Donald Trump's hateful rhetoric and intolerant policy proposals in the strongest possible terms. In the current presidential campaign, they added, "We have been deeply troubled to hear proposals that condemn whole groups and which are justified by pointing to evil behaviors by members of that group or religion." Trump has called for banning Muslims from entering the United States, of course, and later in remarks made in the context of the fight against radical Islam for extreme vetting of immigrants. In a reference to the Captain Humayun Khan incident and Trump's verbal attack on the dead U.S. military hero's parents, the rabbis wrote, "We are shocked by the disrespect shown to parents who suffered the greatest pain losing a son who died in the service of our country. The Torah commands us always to comfort mourners. The fact that the parents criticized a candidate does not justify harsh and hurtful retaliation." The signers represent institutions on the religiously moderate side of modern Orthodoxy, including Rabbi Shmuley Yankelovitz, founder of Uri Letzedek, Rabbi Shmuel Hertzfeld of Ohev Sholem, the National Synagogue in Washington, D.C., Rabbi Jeffrey Fox, Rosh Yeshiva Yeshivat Maharat, Seminary for Orthodox Women, and Rabbi Sarah Hurwitz, the former Rosh Beit Midrash at the Drisha Institute of Manhattan and a former guest of Two Jewish. That was our 2016 presidential election from a Jewish perspective update. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
So I was in Paris not too long ago, and I noticed a couple of very interesting things. One was there were a tremendous number of plaques, many of them dedicated to martyrs of the resistance, not necessarily Jewish, but an awful lot dedicated to Jews, to the deportation places of Jews, to orphanages of Jews that were who were taken away by the Nazis, in addition to sort of some of the famous places of deportation memorial that's right across from Notre Dame on the Isle there. There's lots of plaques, and they're not, as they are in Germany, in German and English, so it's clearly aimed at, like, I don't know, American tourists, really, to me. But they're in French, and so it was very surprising to see so many of these sort of scattered about the city.
I have to say, some of this is relatively new, in the sense that, and what do I mean by new? Much less than 50 years old.
Oh,
because
yeah.
When I lived in France in the late 80s, France still tended to be in denial about much of its history. First of all, in total denial about the war in Algeria.
Right.
Which was way too recent. They hadn't begun to process that yet in the late 80s. It was only 25
years earlier.
I mean,
it's sort of their Vietnam, Algeria.
But even World War II, there was still a lot of mythology about the brave heroes of the resistance, and no, we didn't collaborate with the Nazis in deporting Jews. And there was very little of what you saw in the late 80s. And there was also a very famous incident in which a synagogue was attacked in the mid-80s. And one very famous French politician who will remember remain nameless, said on live TV, "This is really horrible. A lot of Jews were killed, and even some innocent Frenchmen were killed."
I remember that, yeah.
Implying that Jews couldn't be innocent Frenchmen. And France, I think, has come a long way since then. There's been a lot of terrorism. There's been a lot of not only anti-Jewish violence, but anti-French violence. Certainly, the attacks recently in Paris were not directed against Jews in particular.
And the attack in Nice or any right. of the really horrible terror attacks that have taken place in the last year and a half.
Right. And at the same time, France is coming more to terms with its history and examining claims of people to have been heroes of the resistance and whatever. And also honoring the memory of the very large Jewish community that once inhabited Paris.
You know, the other fascinating part is people think that there's no Jewish community left in France or that they're all leaving or that it's a large Jewish community. It's an active Jewish community and there are active synagogues and centers and, you know,
in
it's
many
quite
cities.
Vital. Right.
Probably not as many cities as there used to be in the sense that in smaller cities, Jews are tending to leave. If the Jewish community gets too small and can't sustain a synagogue and a cemetery and a school, whatever, the few remaining Jews tend to move to Paris or Nice or Lyon or Marseille or Toulouse, a bigger city in France, or they move to Montreal, or they move to Netanya.
Right.
I mean, there's a lot of options, but life in small towns in the provinces appears to be no longer an attractive option for many Jews in France.
By the way, that's happened in America too, where small town Jewish life has now concentrated into the cities, not quite the same way, but and maybe not for the same reasons, but a little bit of the same reasons. Thanks, Tom. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
We welcome our Mivina in Israel, Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
Well, today we're going to talk about music because a great Israeli composer, really songwriter, passed away this recently.
Yes, his name is Nachum Heyman, and actually he lived in Bet Alfa for most of his life. He was born in Latvia, but after his parents made Aliyah, he lived in Kibbutz Bet Alfa, which is, again, next to my house.
Right near Beit Shan, right near where you're from.
Yeah.
Bet Alfa, by the way, has a famous synagogue floor, a zodiac floor in it from the Byzantine times. Okay,
Nachon.
So go ahead. I'm
yeah.
sorry.
So he was died. He was 82, but he composed like more than 1,000 songs during his life. And one of his first, very first song he composed was from Shir HaShirim.
Nitzanim, right?
Can you sing it?
Nitzanim.
No, anyway.
You're doing pretty well at it, but I will definitely play a better version than I can do on Nitzanim Niruba. Yeah, we'll play it for sure.
Yeah, and he was the Chatan Pras Israel. He won the Israel Prize.
Israel Prize, right?
Yeah, from the president. Again, like we say in Hebrew, Nechset Zon Barzel, which is the most important, you know, what really create the Israel culture, contain a lot of his songs. I think he wrote one song in his life, but he composed, as I said, more than 1,000. Some of them like very, very famous, lots of them being used during memorial services, right. Yom HaZikaron, because they are very
sad
melody.
And slow from that yeah. kind of Zionist period.
Nachon. Exactly.
Do you think he's the last of the sort of classic Israeli composers to pass from the scene? You know, I think of some of them. And,
one of the last. We say Achron HaMoikanim almost, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. This is generation who really build with their hands. They build the country.
They built the country.
And they connected it in a way that allow themselves to criticize, because it's, you know, they build it. It's theirs. It's yeah. They're not criticize something that
somebody else
others.
Made, but they were part of the Zionists, the pioneering generation, the Chalutzim, really, in their own
and
way.
And his songs is also talked about, the songs that he, of course, composed. But, you know, his statement is, I probably part of this mistake. If there is any mistakes, I'm part of it because I build it.
Because I helped build this.
Bidiuk. So, it's a
yeah.
different approach than you doing wrong.
You know, it's fascinating. For a long time, every song that came out of Israel seemed to be not only beautiful, but it had a cultural connection. It spoke to the heart of the people. It isn't always like that so much with popular music coming out of Israel today. And
not
Heyman
to mention
really,
the Mizrahi.
Yeah.
I love you. You love me. I love you.
You love me, right? It's the kind of stuff that might work in Eurovision, but isn't the same thing as speaking for the heart of the country the way Heyman did. So we'll play some of his music today as part of a memorial. Thank you so much, Ashraf.
Toda Rabbi.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Good morning, John. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov.
So Jewish institutions are not necessarily famous for their mission statements, although nowadays everybody's supposed
ask.
To. Isn't it funny? Like, it always sounds so Christian to me, or I don't know, corporate or something. It just,
yeah,
you know,
corporate.
Our mission,
yeah.
We have the Torah. What do we need? But the truth
ultimate
is,
mission statement.
A real Jewish educational institution needs a mission statement. It needs to have clear objectives in order to accomplish them. talk a little bit about how you work to develop core objectives for your own school, for THA.
Sure. So we just went through a really exciting time developing a new mission statement, actually, and a new logo and some branding and those kinds of things. But that work was built on data. We had real conversations with our community about what they wanted from their Jewish day school in Tucson. And of course, we contracted with a firm to do that work. And we talked to almost 400 people through focus groups, through surveys, through face-to-face conversations and on, current students and families, former students and families, people who were considering THA, people who left before their kids graduated, alumni, current staff, local rabbis and other leadership. So it's a very comprehensive dive into what people want. So knowing what your community is looking for is an important part of the development of a mission, and also knowing why you're there and what the purpose is of Jewish day school, of a Jewish educational program.
You know, it's fascinating because Jewish day schools are sometimes thought of as belonging to one movement or another. There are Orthodox day schools, there are Salman Schechter Conservative Day School.
Right.
But most of them are really community day schools, and they draw from the broader community. So it's very important to get that kind of consensus.
It's really important because every family has their own set of values, has their own expectations, has their own vision for their kids and for their interface with Jewish life and Jewish practice and observance. So each family's different in a community school. And you have to look at that whole spectrum to know what your community needs and also the direction that you're going in. So taking that information and then distilling it and coming up with some kind of outcomes helps inform the dialogue. So we looked at what people want from THA, and we plug it into what's our vision, what's our purpose, why are we here? And through that, working with parents, working with faculty, working with lay leadership, working with the Board of Trustees, we developed a new mission, a new vision, and core values statement for the school. And it becomes the boss. I call it the boss because everything that we do needs to be child-centered and mission appropriate.
And we can talk about the specifics of the mission. I think it's a great introduction to sort of the way any Jewish community, any Jewish educational institution, almost any educational institution, mm-hmm. can figure out what the most important educational values are for its
right.
community. Thanks, John. We'll talk next week.
Toda lecha.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Abe's going on vacation, so he asks his brother Jake to take care of his cat while he's away. When Jake picks him up at the airport, Abe says, "What a great trip. Tell me, how's my cat?" And his brother Jake says, "Your cat died." "Oy," says Abe, "how can you tell a person such terrible news like that? That's not how you do it. You have to break it to me gently. First, you say, 'I've got some bad news. The first day you were away, the cat went up on the roof. I tried to get it down, but I couldn't. On the second day, I put water and food up there, but the poor thing was so scared she wouldn't eat or drink. On the third day, the fire department tried to get your cat down, but their ladder broke. The fourth day, we called for medevac, but the cat was so scared she hid behind the chimney. We couldn't reach her. Fifth day, I hired a mountain climber to get her down, but he couldn't get a good hold of her. She was so skinny, the poor cat. She kept slipping away. Yesterday, we finally managed to get up there, but it was just too late. I'm so sorry." "That's how you're supposed to tell me my cat died." Okay, I'm sorry," his brother answers. They sit in silence for a few moments. Then Abe asks, "So tell me, how's Mom?" And Jake answers, "Well, the first day you were away, Mom went up on the roof." That was the old Jewish joke of the week. Special feature to Jewish just for you. You should live and be well and stay off the roof. And now a word of Torah. It's one of the great quotations in the entire Torah, and it's from this week's reading. "Look, today I set before you a blessing and a curse. The blessing, if you listen to God's commandments." This is a wonderful statement of ethical choice and the foundation of the upcoming season of Tshuva, Return and Repentance, that begins with the month of Elul that starts next Sunday. But as important a sentence as it is, it doesn't match the content of the most valuable teaching in this week's reading. The Torah portion of Re'eh, fourth in the book of Deuteronomy, follows a sequence of marvelous portions with yet another remarkable text, one of the most radical statements in the entirety of the Torah. Ki hiye v'cha evyon me'achad achecha be'achad sharecha. If there is among you a poor man, one of your brothers, within one of your gates, in the land which the Lord your God gives you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand from your needy brother. Ki fatoach tiftach et yadcha lo. You shall certainly open your hand to him and give him enough for whatever he lacks, whatever he wants. The commandment is not simply to provide for the needs of the needy, not simply to alleviate their suffering, but to give them what they want, that is, sustenance, security, a decent life. It is much more than we seek to provide in our own American society, in which the safety net has as many holes as net. It's a powerful, dramatic statement. Open your hand and surely give the needy poor what they ought to have. This is part of the strong economic agenda of Deuteronomy. No one is supposed to accumulate great wealth or enormous power, and no one is to be left destitute. Our moral obligation is to see to it that none of our brothers and sisters is left without what they need to survive. This is a foundational lesson in the morality of giving. Give not only what someone needs in your opinion, give her or him enough to live on reasonably and with dignity. That is the true measure of tzedakah, of living justly and in righteousness. Open your hand and do so freely and generously, because only then will you be able to live long and well. Only then can our society truly be repaired. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guest, Rabbi Jonathan Greenberg, Senior Vice President of the Chaim Solomon Center, will explain just what is going on in terms of Israel on university campuses across America and how we might best advocate for Israel in a challenging environment. Find out when we return here on Too Jewish.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In a first for an Orthodox congregation in Israel, a woman has been hired as the spiritual leader at a Jerusalem synagogue. Carmit Feintuch will serve as the Ramban synagogue alongside Rabbi Benny Lau. She will have the title Rabbanit. The religious Zionist synagogue in the Katamon neighborhood unanimously approved the hiring earlier this month. Feintuch, who has served as an educator at the Migdal Oz Seminary in the West Bank since 2008, will start in September. She'll deal with all aspects of the spiritual life of the community and the connection between man and God, Rabbi Lau said. Feintuch will be the first female communal leader at an Orthodox synagogue in Israel itself. In 2015, Jenny Rosenfeld became the first female communal spiritual leader to serve the Orthodox community of a town in the West Bank settlement of Efrat. Since the establishment of Yeshivat Maharad, a New York seminary ordaining Orthodox women spiritual leaders, a number of modern Orthodox synagogues in the U.S. have hired women for leadership. The first of those who initially took the title of Rabbah was Sarah Hurwitz, a past guest of Too Jewish. In January, the Mount Freedom Jewish Center in Randolph, New Jersey, made history when it hired Rabbi Lila Kagadan, a Yeshivat Maharad graduate, who was the first to adopt the title of Rabbi. Many Orthodox Jews are vehemently opposed to women rabbis, and several mainstream Orthodox rabbis and institutions have ruled that ordaining female rabbis violates Jewish law. In October, the main association of modern Orthodox rabbis, the Rabbinical Council of America, passed a resolution reaffirming its opposition and barring member rabbis from hiring women with clergy-like titles. Lau said that Feintuch will help the synagogue grow. All congregations must, like a tree, renew themselves, grow and develop. Carmeet is going to help our community grow bigger, sweeter, and more beautiful fruit. And this is why we have made this appointment. More than 50% of the community are women, so why shouldn't there be a woman in a leadership role? Rabbi Lau said, this isn't something we feel is a radical step. Stephen Hill, an Orthodox Jewish actor best known for playing Jewish Manhattan District Attorney on the hit TV series Law and Order, has died at the age of 94. Hill, who was the original star of the TV show Mission Impossible back in the 1960s, but was replaced after one season by Peter Graves because he couldn't rehearse or tape on Friday nights or Saturday, sacrificed numerous career opportunities in order to observe Shabbat. On NBC's Law & Order, Stephen Hill played District Attorney Adam Schiff for more than 225 episodes from 1990 to 2000, earning two Emmy nominations for Outstanding Actor in a Drama Series. Schiff was loosely modeled on longtime Manhattan DA Robert Morgenthau, who was also Jewish. Law & Order creator Dick Wolf called Hill the Talmudic influence on the entire zeitgeist of the series. Stephen has more moral authority than anyone else on episodic TV. Wolf also said Stephen was not only one of the truly great actors of his generation, he was one of the most intelligent people I've ever met. He will be missed. But fortunately, he could be seen ubiquitously on Law & Order reruns.
Started with a killing, ending with an execution. You got what you wanted. Take the rest of the week off.
It's Friday, Adam.
So it is. See you Monday.
And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning. Rabbi Jonathan Greenberg is a senior vice president of the Chaim Solomon Center for American Jewish Thought. He has written widely on Israel for the Jerusalem Post, New York Daily News, Washington Times, and many other publications. He spent a couple of years as vice president at the Illinois Policy Institute, a think tank, and 5 years at AIPAC, and has been working on this, as we heard earlier in the show, for about a year and a half. What do you see as the most important issues that Israel is trying to address, or that the Chaim Solomon Center is trying to address on behalf of Israel, perhaps, in the American popular opinion, American cultural understanding of Israel now?
I think that the view that most Americans have of the conflict in the Middle East generally, but as it pertains specifically to Israel, is pretty skewed. And it's skewed by the amount of coverage that it gets, which I think is disproportionate to the global significance of that conflict. And it's skewed by the people who are doing the reporting and the biases that they bring to the table. Now, I'm a big believer in Hayden White's theory in meta-history that he's talking about history, all historiography, all writing of history is inherently ideological. I think that everything that human beings write is inherently ideological, and you can either be aware of your biases or not, and you can either alert your readers to them or not. The overwhelming majority of what's written about Israel, the Palestinians in the Middle East, is written by people who are either unaware of their anti-Israel biases or don't care to alert their readers of them.
Most surveys, I think almost all surveys of American popular opinion, show a tremendously high level of support for Israel, highest that it's ever been. How does that happen if there's a bias in the media against it?
Well, I think it happens in spite of it. I think that, first of all, that's a lot of that is either residual of a time when this didn't happen. I think this is a relatively recent, the last 30 years or so. As you know, those numbers are lower among younger consumers of information.
Yeah, that was my follow-up.
So over the last 30 years, as the media has portrayed Israel differently, you have seen a dent in those numbers, even though those numbers are still very high. I think one of the reasons why we can be so effective, what I'm trying to do can be so effective, is because we're still culturally pushing on an open door. I think most Americans are still kind of knee-jerk pro-Israel, even though they may have questions, even though they may have concerns, their reaction is still a pro-Israel reaction. So we're still pushing on an open cultural door, which is why now I think is the time to make those changes to the way the media portrays Israel.
Let's talk about the way that younger people, younger Jews, millennials, and I'm not sure what the next generation is going to be called. Post-millennials, that sounds almost post-apocalyptic, doesn't it? There's a very different understanding on American college campuses about Israel than there is in the society at large. Let's explore that a little bit.
Well, I think that's true from an activist standpoint. I'm not sure that it's true. I'm not sure how broadly that reaches. I think, you know, most kids go to college and they're not particularly politically active and they want to, you know, have fun for a few years and then go out and get a job.
And maybe learn something along the way if it happens.
Right. But most importantly is have fun and go get a job. I think most kids go to college for that reason. And so I think there is a growing movement against Israel on campus. You know, one of the things that my organization does is report extensively on BDS actions on campus, anti-Jewish stuff on campus. We just broke a story this week, actually, about some of what's going on at the University of Tennessee. And I don't know if you saw that report, but it is a growing problem on campus. Why it's happening? I think it's because Israel's enemies are better organized and they know where to go to get more of a hearing. You go to college campuses where kids are more interested in radical politics. You go to the fringes of both sides of the political aisle where people are more interested in radical politics. And that's where you're going to get a fairer hearing if you're kind of a more fringy political opinion, which is what Israel's enemies are. So I think they've gotten smarter. They've gotten better organized. I think the Jewish community is also pretty divided. I think one of the things that we pride ourselves on is being good Enlightenment liberals. You know, you and I like to hear what the other side has to say. Where we can, we like positive sum solutions where everybody wins. And those very Western values are used against us by Israel's enemies. It's something that Professor Richard Landis at Boston University calls demopathy, a sociopath hates people or society. A demopath hates democracy, and they use those things against us. And they've been largely, I think they've been increasingly successful, which is, again, I think why organizing against them is more important at this time than ever before.
Do you see the openness of college campus? I mean, that's not likely to change. How can those people who wish to get a more balanced picture of Israel, for Palestinians not to be the principal focus in places which, you know, you would think we'd be interested in many other things, what's the best strategy for approaching that challenge?
I think that the first step is that, from a Jewish standpoint, you know, since we're Jewishly speaking, now, I think the most important...
The show is called Too Jewish, just to, you know.
So if we're going to be too Jewish about it, I think the focus should be on, and this is why, you know, the Jewish community loves organizational responses, don't we?
Yeah.
We love to start an organization and make sure it's very well funded and get the best staff that we can and then address problems that way. I think this problem kind of defies that
approach.
I think that's not to say that there isn't organizational work that can be done, but I think the overall approach has to be one at the family level. Jewish parents have to be better about teaching their kids an unapologetic Zionist narrative. It sounds a lot like indoctrinating because it kind of is. I believe that there is an unapologetic Zionist narrative. I think that the truth is generally on our side, and I think that if we were better about teaching our kids fiercely to promote that, we'd be doing better, for example, on campus. You know, one of the reasons we lose the debate on campus a lot of the time is that our arguments lack passion. The Palestinians are talking about rights and, liberty and justice, and we're talking about, yes, but Israel developed this application that's on your mobile phone, and the two don't measure up in the eyes of most college kids.
I've often thought that the American Jewish community just kind of sent its kids off to college, figured Hillel would take care of things, and let's not worry about it. And let's worry about the big things, like raising money for Israel. That's not working now, is it?
No, it absolutely isn't. And I think that more and more local Jewish communities are realizing that you have to prepare kids for what they're going to encounter on college campuses. My organization actually started a project called Track BDS, where we're going to have lay videographers, kids on college campuses all over the country, videotaping BDS rallies. And I don't want it to just stop at BDS rallies. I want it to be sneak into organizing meetings and videotape what's going on. The next time Students for Justice in Palestine put eviction notices on Jewish kids' doors in the dorms, I want videotape of it. And we're going to create an online database so that, in addition to us generating press coverage of it, which is what my organization does, your synagogue and synagogues like it around the country and Jewish high schools are going to be able to tap into that archive and show kids, this is what you're going to see next year. And Hillels at schools that haven't had to deal with an Israel Apartheid Week, they're going to be able to see what Israel Apartheid Week looks like at other college campuses, and they're going to be able to prepare accordingly.
The work that you do is creating position papers, encouraging speakers. Tell us sort of how it works.
We produce content, actually. It's not just, I speak around the country, but we actually produce media content. So we have reporters who work for us and freelancers who write stories for us that we then place in mainstream press. We're actually in the process of moving our hard news content over to kind of an outside organization that we're forming so that we can keep the opinion side and the news side separate, which is something you're supposed to do. We also produce a ton of opinion editorial content. We're in probably four or five different publications a week, and these are all mainstream. You listed a few of the ones that I've been in, but we've been in USA Today, we've been on FoxNews.com, we've been kind of a Daily Caller. I mean, I could go on and on, all over the place. And again, the idea is not the Forward, which is a great publication, but not the Forward, not the local Jewish paper. The idea here is to get in mainstream press, not just talking to the Jewish community. We're trying to communicate with a broader American audience.
So there's a perception that the American press is liberal and not accepting of positive ideas about Israel. Yet if you read stories, it's kind of a broad range. What are your feelings?
I don't know if it's liberal or conservative by American political standards, although I do think that there are some problems brewing on both left and right, different kinds of problems. But I think that the voices generally in the media are ignorant of what's going on in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, what's going on. I think these issues are just too complicated for the majority of newspaper folks to pay a lot of attention to. You have to remember, there's been a lot of creative destruction in the past 10 years in the newspaper business. The overwhelming, you're in Tucson, the local paper in Tucson, the local paper in Phoenix, they have fewer staff to do the same job that they used to have.
Newspaper business is kind of going away slowly in exchange for online access to news, right?
It's moving online, but that doesn't mean that, the information consumption is up.
Right.
Newspaper subscriptions, hard newsprint is down. But the media business, you have much more information consumption than you used to have. And so the way that the business is trending is away from expertise and toward online marketing. And, there are fewer and fewer foreign correspondents, people who really know what's going on the ground. The foreign correspondents that you have covering this particular issue, as we discussed earlier, are generally not favorable to the Israeli side of things. And so the coverage that you pretty much get is bad. And, the guy who aggregates the 2 pages worth of international news that go in the Cleveland Plain Dealer, that guy's, it's 2 pages of international news, and whatever comes through on the Middle East is ripped off of the Associated Press, more than likely, or aggregated from the Associated Press, Reuters, and Agence France-Presse.
Right, pulling stuff off the wires and plopping it into the paper. There's not a lot of analysis.
Right, and that's true online, too. So if you're, with the exception of the Times, the Washington Post, the big TV channels, a few others, there aren't foreign correspondents. There are freelance people and there are wires.
Kind of a broader question. Why has the cause of Palestinians become the most important cause for on campus, around the world, particularly in Europe, but really in America as well? Why has that particular liberation cause become the central one?
It's a multifaceted answer. You have to, I think, start with anti-Semitism. I think that Jew hatred has not gone away. It has morphed into an anti-Zionism that is more genteel and more acceptable, and so people who hate Jews are now able to hate Israelis or hate Zionists or whatever and get away with it in a way they weren't before. So I think that's where a lot of it starts. I think that our opponents on campus are really good at marketing themselves, and especially to the left. I just finished a piece now on the platform for the Movement for Black Lives, which unfortunately includes the charge of race,
genocide and apartheid, right,
against Israel, and supports the BDS movement. And that ability that the Palestinian Liberation Movement has to embed itself in leftist movements in the West really can't be overstated. They've done a tremendous job of seeking allies in those communities. And what's frustrating, I think, for a lot of Jews is those are communities that we see as typical allies of ours. And so it hurts us even more that the Movement for Black Lives would say these things about what really is Jew hatred. The BDS movement is Jew hatred. And that they would say things like that about the Jewish community when we feel like we are their partners. But the Palestinian Liberation Movement has been terrific about embedding itself there. You got to give it to them.
You know, it has been effective, and it's startling because it seems like such. It's the only real foreign policy element there. Jonathan, where can people go to find out more about the Chaim Salomon Center and the work that you do?
We are at SalomonCenter.org. S-A-L-O-M-O-N Center.org. Almost all of our work, I think, is there. Our opinion editorial, our hard news content is all archived there. We're actually in the process of overhauling that site, so hopefully it'll even be readable by the time your listeners get there.
Asking so much. Thanks for a great visit. I want to thank Rabbi Jonathan Greenberg for a great visit. You can find out more at if you think about it as an A, SalomonCenter.org. And good luck with your continued work on behalf of Israel.
Thank you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Our guest will be Cantor Richard Cohen, director of the Debbie Friedman School of Sacred Music at Hebrew Union College Jewish Institute of Religion in New York. Our playout this morning comes from the Maccabees, covering the classic schlock rock tune Minion Man with an original schlock rock leader, Lenny Solomon. My friends, may you have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
I asked the man I saw how many Jews in this town. He said to me there used to be a minion around. But one of us passed away and we've been feeling down. Yet now it seems as though another Jew has been found. Won't you stay with us for Shabbos, Minion Man? I stepped off the bus in Mobile, Alabama. The sun was slowly setting on the bay. It was 6 o'clock on a summer Friday afternoon. Shabbos was an hour away. I walked around the town wondering what to do. The Shabbos is no time to be feeling blue. And then I saw a man who looked the same way too. I was quite relieved to find the fellow Jew. I asked the man I saw how many Jews in this town.
me there used to be a minion around, but one of us passed away and we've been feeling down. Yet now it seems as though another Jew has been found. Won't you stay with us for Shabbos, Minion Man?
We walked down Winston Avenue, a block then two more. Went into a shop that read closed on the door.
There was a minion in the back of a hardware store. Nine men waiting for one more.
Sponsored by two Jewish radio programs, Tucson, Arizona.